Welcome to Hebraic Insights in the Gospels. Join us every Sabbath on Zion Road Radio for a look at the life, deeds, and words of Yeshua Messiah and his followers from the Torah-centric Hebraic perspective they were originally lived and written in. Today's program is on Luke chapter 16. Please get out your Bible and follow along. Why are some of the parables that Messiah shared in Luke 16 so confusing to modern readers? What did Messiah mean when he said to make friends by means of unrighteous mammon? When he said the Torah and the prophets were until John, does that mean the Torah and the prophets are done away with now? Why did he suddenly mention divorcing one's wife in the middle of the chapter? Does the parable of the beggar named Lazarus resting at Abraham's bosom indicate that Messiah believes in heaven and hell? What do the scriptures say happens after death? If we're not spending eternity in hell, and we're all saved anyway, why should we, as believers, store up treasure in heaven instead of here on earth? Stay tuned throughout today's program for Eliyahu ben David's insight on these questions and more in Luke chapter 16. And now, here's Eliyahu ben David.
Shabbat shalom, everybody. We're going through the book of Luke pretty fast. We've already gone through Matthew and Mark, and now we're more than halfway through the book of Luke. What a privilege it is for us to be his servants and to be hearing from Yeshua Messiah as he speaks to us through these Gospels to prepare us as citizens of his kingdom. And right now that's happening. And he wants to actually teach us what we need to know to bring us into his eternal kingdom when he returns. So it's truly a special privilege for us to be able to go through this together as his people and learn the things he has for us. You know, we're just living in a world where so many people are running after riches. This is the main focus in this world. It's what drives this world. And in Luke 16, Yeshua reminds us, you cannot serve God and mammon. You know, a lot of people think they can. They think they can make God in heaven their God and the God mammon their God. But, you know, with Elohim, you have to choose one or another. He doesn't share his glory with another God. So you must choose one or the other. Well, I wanted to share a few things about this, and we'd like to start by taking a look at the parable of the dishonest manager. And one thing I'd like to say, when you read through Luke 16, this particular chapter is very problematic. It has lots of stuff in it that really doesn't sound a lot like it originated with Yeshua. And so this makes it confusing. And I think one of the reasons for that is that in some of Yeshua's parables, what he's actually doing, you know, we read it, we're thinking, okay, he's the one that made up this story. But that's not always true. In some of these parables, what he's doing is drawing on popular stories of the day and putting his little twist on it in order to make his point. It's kind of like in my radio series, On the Road to Zion, I have some programs I call the Matrix series. And I draw on the Matrix movie in order to bring out certain important points, because the Matrix movie gives me sort of a common ground with other people that I can talk about these issues. And I believe this is actually what is going on here with these parables here in Luke chapter 16. So I think this is one of the reasons why this parable of the dishonest manager is kind of difficult for people to understand, because I believe Yeshua is taking like a popular story and then adjusting it to make his point. Well, let's go through this and I'll bring out some of the points here. In the first couple of verses, it tells us about the rich man who has this manager who at least hasn't been managing well and may have been stealing. And so what do you do if you have a manager like that and you're the boss? It's only one thing you can do. You have to fire him, don't you? You can't say, oh, I'll give you another chance, because the man is probably a thief. If you give him another chance, he'll keep robbing you. So he had to fire him, and he fired him. So then what happens, unfortunately, though, I think the owner here was not a very good manager, because he didn't just escort him out the door like they do now, right? It looks like he gave him some kind of notice. So here's what happened. This dishonest manager, he's thinking about this, and he's thinking, oh boy, what's going to happen to me now? So he comes up with an idea. He's thinking, okay, once I leave here, I'm not good with my current boss anymore. So I have to get in good with some other people. And then maybe I'll be able to get another position or something that way. So that's what he did. He decided he would make some friends. So by going to customers of his current manager, he says, okay, you owe such and such amount of oil. Change it on your paper to this, and I'll agree to that. And does that for a number of different things. And he does make a lot of friends doing this, right? Giving everybody a discount, if you will, but not an honest discount, a dishonest discount. Do people actually do this stuff? They really do. People actually do this stuff in order to promote themselves. This is really how people who aren't you operate. That's what I'm telling you. That's what Messiah was telling you. So it says here, his master commended the dishonest manager because he had done wisely. Now, myself, I don't think the master, now the master here is not Yahweh, it's not Yeshua, it's just the guy's boss. And I don't think he knew what the guy did. That's how I see it. I don't think he knew that the guy went and changed all the papers with all those people. I think what he knew is that these other people who were customers had really good things to say about the dishonest manager. That's what I think happened. That's why people do this stuff, right? And so I think that's what he thought was wise. I don't think he necessarily knew how the man achieved it, but I think he saw that this man had been able to get people on his side. And he thought that was wise. I believe if he knew that the man had cheated him beyond what he already had done, he wouldn't be commending him. So that's how I see that. But the story here is very interesting in the way in which Yeshua draws from this story. What he says is, for the children of this world are in their own generation wiser than the children of the light. And then he says, I tell you, make for yourselves friends by means of unrighteous mammon, so that when you fail, they may receive you into the eternal tents. Now, all this language, the way it's put together, is very strange. So that's why I think this story wasn't really originally from Yeshua. I think he's adapting the story. But the point he's making here, I think, is very clear. What he's saying is that in the world, they're very shrewd. They're very wise in how they advance themselves. And they take and they use the resources they have in order to advance themselves. But in the kingdom, a lot of times we don't have that kind of wisdom. The children of light, a lot of times, unfortunately, just coast along. We don't really always utilize the gifts that we have, even the wealth that we have, in a way to promote the kingdom. And I think part of it is because, you know, we have some old ideas that aren't really how Yahweh works. Like, for instance, you know, to us, we think, well, Yahweh has the cattle on 1,000 hills. He doesn't need my $12 a month or whatever it is. And the thing is, if you know the Torah, you know, when he established the tabernacle, he looked to the people to provide for that. He didn't just send a pile of gold from heaven. He looked to the people so that they could have the blessing of giving. And then he actually arranged for the upkeep of the tabernacle and for the support of those working in the tabernacle. And where did that all come from? That all came from the support of the people. And then as they gave support, what did Yahweh promise them? He would bless them. And so I think because we're not under that system anymore, that temple system, sometimes we do get kind of lax on some of these things. And we really are not as wise as the people of the world. You know, they're diligent, especially the really greedy people. The really greedy people work really hard. And they do it just like this. You know, they call it networking. They network with all the other people that they think can help them. This is what they do. And they have all these big meetings, like the Davos Economic Forum. The people they invite are the multi-billionaires who are the movers and shakers of the economy of the entire world. So why would all those guys get together every year at Davos? The answer is very clear. They want to arrange things in the world so that they keep the wealth coming to them and not to you. That's really the reason they're doing that. Just like this guy, this dishonest manager. They're very diligent in what they do. Yeshua tells us, I tell you, make for yourselves friends by means of unrighteous mammon. Whoa! Dang, would you expect Yeshua to say that? Would you? Tell me the truth. Would you expect that? Doesn't that knock you out when you read that? Make for yourselves friends by means of unrighteous mammon. You know what? The money isn't bad. Greed is bad. What you do with it, if you use it selfishly, is bad. Yahweh gives some people a gift to make money. He gives them gifts to be businessmen. And a lot of times they think, oh, that's great. I'll go and become a billionaire. And they totally miss the reason Yahweh gave them those gifts, just like he gives all kinds of other gifts. It's to build up the kingdom. He didn't give it to them for their own selfish use. Right? So that's what he means when he says, make for yourselves friends by means of unrighteous mammon. What friends do you think he's talking about? He's talking about Elohim and his son, Yeshua. Do you want them to be your friends? You can actually make friends with Elohim and with his son through how you use unrighteous mammon. Now, isn't that something? Mammon here meaning physical wealth, money. I like better the way the Lamsa New Testament puts this. Now, the New Testament we are normally using is translated from Greek. The Lamsa translation is translated from the Peshitta Aramaic text. So it's a little different, and to me, it makes more sense. It has Yeshua saying, and I also say, use this earthly wealth, however acquired, to make friends, so that when it is gone, they will receive you, and you will have everlasting habitation. To me, that's much more clear that the friends that it's talking about are Yahweh and his son Yeshua. That how we use our earthly wealth helps to pave the way for our everlasting reward. This is such an important issue. And you know, Yeshua goes on and he says more. Now, this is so important. This is like, you know, people often tell me, I would really like to be promoted in the kingdom. This is how you do it right here. Yeshua is presenting the principle of kingdom promotion. If you want to be promoted in the kingdom, this is what you do. He who is faithful in a very little is faithful also in much. He who is dishonest in a very little is also dishonest in much. You know, the scriptures don't really advocate a situation where you give someone a job and then you keep having to watch them and harp on them to do the job. It's the principle of faithfulness. So, for instance, if in your place of worship, you have the job of scrubbing the toilets, maybe that's not the job you want to do. Maybe you'd like to be like the music minister in the congregation, or you'd like to do some other job. But that's not the job you get. The job you get is cleaning the toilets because they really need to be done. Well, if that's the job you get, he who is faithful in a very little is faithful also in much. If you do a good job at that job, then eventually that will come to the attention of those who are looking for people that they can depend on. If you can depend on somebody to clean the toilet, you can depend on them to do a lot more than that. But if you can't depend on them to even do that, how likely are they ever going to get promoted? You see what I'm saying? That's how it works in the kingdom. If you have to have people keep harping on you to do your job, don't expect to be promoted because it's not going to happen. That's how it is. If, therefore, you've not been faithful in the unrighteous mammon, who will commit to your trust the true riches? The true riches. Who's it talking about here? Talking about Yahweh, right? You know, a lot of us have been trained to have a very narrow vision about eternal rewards. You know, for instance, in the Christian church, you're either in or you're out. That's all they really know. You're either saved, and then, you know, from there, how they see it is you're in heaven forever and everything's good, and you're just like everybody else in heaven. Everybody is kind of like equally blessed. Or you're out, and that's all equally bad, right? But that's not what the scriptures tell us. It's not what Yeshua tells us. We're going to get into some parables that he has where he explains this to us, that there are different levels of rewards. So I'm not going to teach all that right now. But the whole point is, he's looking at this as a test. What you do with your wealth, he's looking at that as a test as to what he wants to give you in terms of true riches in eternity. See, that's what this is all about. That's why you're here right now. This is not it. Okay, this is not it. This is just the place where you're being tested and prepared for what is it. So what you do here is all about there. That's a lot about what this whole chapter is about. Because people get sidetracked into here, when really, everything that matters is about there. And that's what Yeshua is saying here, right? Okay, so you've got some money. Use it for the kingdom, for there, not here. That's what he's saying. And then he says, if you have not been faithful in that which is another's, who will give you that which is your own? That's quite a concept. Your own. Do you have anything in this world that is your own? Do you own a house? Oh, you think you do. But is it your own? Try not paying your taxes some year and you'll find out who really owns your house. And on. Our Father wants to give us what is something that is truly our own. Do you know what he wants to give you? Indestructible, immortal, eternal life. This is life within yourself, like he has. Do you think he's just going to trust just anybody with that? What if you turn out to be the person that isn't worthy of that and you decide to hang up your own shingle like some other guy we know about? Haven't we had enough of that? So yeah, you know, there's some hoops people have to go through to separate the men from the boys, if you will. We got to do it. It's fair. It's right. It's for everybody's good. So if it matters enough to us to be there, to have the eternal riches, then that's going to affect how we look at everything in the world we're in. It's that simple. Well, here's some more. Let's look at Malachi 3:8 in view of that last statement. If you have been faithful in that which is another's, who will give you that which is your own? Will a man rob Elohim? Yet you rob me. But you say, how have we robbed you? In tithes and offerings. You know what? A lot of us are just like that dishonest manager. We want to keep what belongs to God. We want to rob him because every buck that comes into our hand, we think of that as our buck. Well, 10% of it does not belong to you. It belongs to Elohim and to his kingdom. And for you to hang on to it for yourself is robbing him. And I'm just telling you because that's what the scriptures tell you. Now, if you think of this in view of the verse above, if you have not been faithful in that which is another's, that 10% that belongs to Yahweh, who will give you that which is your own? Say, for instance, your inheritance in the remnant Exodus. No servant can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or else he will hold to one and despise the other. You aren't able to serve Elohim and Mammon. Is there anything about that we don't understand? And yet, there are so many people who claim to follow Messiah who try to do this, right? They say their life is about serving God, and yet all of the energy of their life is about making themselves rich. As a matter of fact, there are whole companies that just feed off of Christians. I remember when I was a young believer, somebody came to me about Amway. Has anybody ever heard of that? Well, Amway is a network marketing scheme. And they prey off of Christians. And there are entire Amway congregations. And you know what they talk about all the time? Amway. They're not talking about Messiah. They're not talking about the kingdom. They're talking about Amway. And they go to these Amway meetings. And at the Amway meetings, you know what they talk about? Amway. And every once in a while, they'll mention the Lord to mix him in with the Amway. Amway, for all practical purposes, is mammon. This is just one example. What Yeshua says, you know, I really like him because I'm a black and white kind of guy, and so is he. Right? Okay, this is a choice. Choose one or the other. I can deal with that. You know, like two genders, I can deal with that. 57, I don't know how to figure that out. Whenever people go beyond what is very simple in the scriptures, I think they're throwing up a smokescreen. That's how it looks to me. And we see a lot of that. That's why we need to do what we're doing. Because nobody's going to fool you after you know this. Nobody but you. You can fool yourself at any point, right? But you know it. Well, what about mammon? What is mammon? Albert Barnes' commentary tells us about mammon. Mammon is a Syriac word, a name given to an idol worshipped as the god of riches. It has the same meaning as Plutus among the Greeks. And it is not known that the Jews ever formally worshipped this idol, But they use the word to denote wealth. So it's kind of like the word January. January is the name of a false god, actually Janus, but it's also the name of a month. So we might very commonly, even believers, of course, use the word January, but it really is derived from the god of that month. Well, this word mammon is a word like that. It can just mean riches. It can mean greed. And that's named after the god mammon. And I think it's interesting that in saying you cannot serve God and mammon, I believe Yeshua is actually using this word on purpose, because he's connecting the god of wealth with the wealth itself. And there is a very powerful demon behind this. There's a very powerful demon behind this greed after wealth. People get gripped with this thing as if they were on cocaine or something. You know, have you ever seen that? Have you ever seen people that are just so gripped by this thing? There really is a demonic energy behind it. And that very well could be this mammon god, this demonic force behind this greed. So I think that's a very interesting thing. And realizing that's true, we need to be very careful with this. You know, we need to use our wealth with the kind of wisdom Yeshua is talking about. We have to be in control of it and his purposes. And however, we have to really avoid getting into the grip of this demonic spirit that is behind greed. Well, this sets the pace for the rest of the chapter. And I think if there was a phrase that shows the motivations behind the entire chapter, it would be this phrase: the Pharisees were lovers of money. And of all people, they were the people you wouldn't want to be lovers of money, right? Because they're the religious leaders of the people. They should be devoted to spiritual interests, right? They should be devoted to caring for the people. But instead, they're just interested in hoarding their own wealth and everything that goes with that. So this is what Yeshua is addressing in this chapter. It says, the Pharisees, who were lovers of money, also heard all these things, and they scoffed at him. And he said to them, you are those who justify yourselves in the sight of men, but Elohim knows your hearts. For that which is exalted among men is an abomination in the sight of Elohim. You see, they were just like the dishonest manager, weren't they? That's what he's saying. They were elevating themselves in the sight of other people. Why were they doing that? The same reason the dishonest manager was doing that: to enrich themselves. So it really just kind of goes all together. And then, though, he's telling them, Elohim knows who you are. He knows what you're doing. He knows your hearts. And he calls them an abomination. And truly they were, because they were behaving in a way exactly opposite to how the leaders of Israel should behave. Should not the leaders of Israel in some way mirror Yahweh himself. When people would go to the leaders of Israel, didn't they have a right to think that they were going to have the love of Yahweh expressed towards them, the wisdom of Yahweh, the right and correct understanding of his commandments? And yet, what were they doing? They were actually twisting the Torah in order to lift up themselves and to enrich themselves. In this, they were a lot like many of the religious leaders and teachers today, with mansions, private airplanes, all of this stuff. And how do they get it? They all get it by twisting the scriptures. They all get it by telling people something they want to hear, something to make them feel good, and make them ready to part with their money. That's what they're all doing. We have Pharisees today. We have a lot of them. And they just keep doing the same stuff. Yeshua goes on, the Torah and the prophets were until John. From that time, the good news of the kingdom of Elohim is preached and everyone is forcing his way into it. The Jewish New Testament commentary explains these verses. It says, up to the time of Yohanan, the immerser, there were the Torah and the prophets giving their prophetic and predictive witness to the coming of the kingdom of God. The verse does not mean that the authority of the Torah and the prophets came to an end when Yohanan appeared. But since then, in addition to their witness, the good news of the kingdom of God, which is now near, had been proclaimed directly, first by Yohanan and now by Yeshua, with the result that everyone is pushing to get in. So the idea is very simple here, but sometimes you'll find these verses quoted. The Torah and the prophets were until John. And then they'll tell you that means the Torah and the prophets are done away with now because John and Yeshua have come. This explanation, what it's actually saying is, things changed once Yohanan came, because this was no longer a future message. Like in the Torah and the prophets, it's all pointing forward to the coming of Messiah. But now, when Yeshua was speaking, the Messiah had come. The kingdom now was there. But does that mean the Torah and the prophets were over? Well, the people that say this, for some reason, they don't go on to the next verse. Because the very next verse explains, but it is easier for heaven and earth to pass away than for one tiny stroke of a pen in the Torah to become void. That should settle that issue, right? And then it says, everyone who divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery. He who marries one who is divorced from a husband commits adultery. Now, for a lot of Christian commentators, they get to this and they say, that's totally out of context. They must have kind of thrown that verse in or something when they were putting this together. But actually, it's not out of context at all. Again, I turn to the Lamsa New Testament. It says, he who marries the one who is illegally separated commits adultery. And I've already taught on this before, so I'm not going to get into the whole adultery thing. The Torah, now what Yeshua taught is exactly what the Torah taught. But the problem was that the Pharisees did not teach what the Torah taught. That was the real thing. They were doing just what these other guys do, what those guys do. They were twisting it so that people would like them and give them money. So how are they doing that? Well, I have an example. Matthew 14:3. Herod had laid hold of John and bound him and put him in prison for the sake of Herodias, his brother Philip's wife. Herod had done exactly what the Torah said not to do. He had taken his brother's wife for himself. Under the Torah, this was adultery. So none of the Pharisees were out there saying, Herod, you shouldn't be doing that because that's adultery. The prophet John was doing that. That's what prophets do. And so he was pointing that out, but none of the Pharisees said that. Do you know why? They conveniently changed the meaning of the Torah on divorce. And instead of going by what the Torah really said, by the time they were done with it, they said what it meant was that a man could divorce his wife for any sort of complaint, even burning the soup. And you know, I don't like eating burnt soup, but really, huh? And that made it then so that they didn't have to make an issue with the big money. You see what I'm saying? So that's why Yeshua was mentioning about adultery, because this was really the perfect example of them doing exactly what the dishonest manager was doing. So it really all pulls together. And that's why he put in that thing about you can't change the Torah, because they were changing the Torah. Okay, here's a little change of pace. People of our generation, if we say the Matrix, we know what we're talking about, don't we? We're talking about this story. 100 years from now, somebody should read a conversation where we have said the Matrix this, the Matrix that. I'm going to take the red pill, things like this. I think people would really have trouble understanding what we're talking about, right? Or if you said, hi-o, silver, what would that be? Right? I'm off to see the wizard. Well, you see, all of these stories are about real things, you could say, but are the stories themselves real? Is there somewhere over the rainbow? Can you jack into the Matrix? Sort of, but not really, right? Can you beam up to the Enterprise? You see, it's interesting about these things because these are all worlds, fictional worlds that have a certain kind of reality in our head, and yet we know they're not real. Well, the reason I point all this out is because Yeshua next gives us the parable of the rich man and Lazarus, and it's just like these stories. It's a morality play from the time of Yeshua. And you might not know this, but Nazareth was located right next to a bigger city that had a theater. And they put on plays there all the time. And it's very possible that Yeshua heard many of these stories and actually saw them as plays acted out. You don't think of him like that, do you? Well, they had a high civilization in that time. So just like we have our stories and things, they did too. So people would go there, go to the theater, pay a drachma or something, and go in and see the play. They had that. Well, what about this story? In Rediscovering the Parables, the author says this. To understand the parable in detail and as a whole, we have to recognize that the first part derives from well-known folk material concerned with the reversal of fortune in the afterlife. This is the Egyptian folktale of the journey of Osiris and his father, Setmekhemos, or whatever, to the underworld. It ends with the words, "He who has been good on earth will be blessed in the kingdom of the dead, and he who has been evil on earth will suffer in the kingdom of the dead." Alexandrian Jews, there was a big community of Jews in Alexandria, Egypt, okay, brought this story to Palestine, where it became very popular as the story of the poor scholar and the rich tax collector, Bar Majon. So that's the history of this parable. Now, in the book, The Fire That Consumes, Edward Fudge also comments on it. He says, the plot of the parable, the reversal of earthly fortunes after death, was familiar in popular Palestinian stories of Jesus' time. Hugo Gressman cites a Greek parallel from a first century Egyptian papyrus, and he says there are at least seven versions of the story in Jewish literature. One of the most famous involved a poor student of the law and a rich publican named Bar Majon. There are differences between these stories and Jesus, of course, and therein lies the Lord's uniqueness. But the base plot was well-known folklore. Froome cites a discourse of Josephus concerning Hades, which paints almost precisely the same picture found in Luke. He concludes that, quote, Jesus was clearly using a then common tradition of the Jews to press home a moral lesson in a related field. So just like The Matrix, or Star Trek, or The Lone Ranger, or The Wizard of Oz, this was a popular morality play, a fictional play, which apparently originated in Egypt, and then kind of went through the Greeks and finally got adapted by the Jews. Very much, for instance, like American movies in a way. You know, we have these stories in these movies, and then they end up going around the world kind of thing. It was sort of like that. So I believe understanding this about this parable saves us from over-literalizing the parable. Because just like if you're watching Star Trek and you thought that the Enterprise was a real thing, you'd be hiding under your desk when the phasers fired, right? This parable can do the same thing to you. If you think that it's real, it can leave you ready to hide under the desk because of what it's saying. But that's not the point of the parable if we understand what it is, that it's being adapted from popular literature in order to explain a point. So let's look at it and see what it's saying. Okay, we have the beggar and that died. And of course, it tells us the whole story about him, that he was at the door of the rich man looking for a few crumbs just to get by. And of course, the rich man totally ignored him because he was too busy hoarding more wealth, right? So after time, the beggar died. He's carried away by the angels to Abraham's bosom. I think that's interesting. And the rich man also died and was buried. In Sheol, he lifted up his eyes, being in torment, and saw Abraham far off and Lazarus at his bosom. So this, except it introduces Abraham, it gives them different names that are Jewish names, such as Lazarus. But other than the name changes, it's following the story very closely from the Egyptians. The whole point of this story comes when Abraham tells Lazarus, son, remember that in your lifetime you received your good things and Lazarus in the same way bad things. But now here he is comforted and you are in anguish. This is what I like to refer to as the big switcheroo. Look out for the big switcheroo. That's what Yeshua is basically saying with this parable. Because what he's saying is, if you live your life today like this rich man, and you just focus on today, then when you get into eternity, what's going to happen to you? Yeah, big switcheroo. You don't want that. You're on the top here, but there, you're going to be in the bottom of the barrel. And what about Lazarus? Well, I don't think this means that every beggar is going to inherit eternal life. But I would assume about this Lazarus that he was a good person with a good heart and had some bad circumstances in his life. So the big switcheroo is good for him, isn't it? No more sores, no more being hungry. He's in the bosom of Abraham. What a wonderful place to be. Right? Abraham, Yahweh's friend, and he's Abraham's friend. Can't be in a better place than that if you're a Jew. The big switcheroo. That's really the whole point of the parable. And while the parable is a story, the point of the story is absolutely true. Well, it goes on. After Abraham tells him, no, you know, you can't come over here. We can't help you. We're not going to put some water on your tongue. Sorry, you're stuck. He says, I ask you therefore, Father, that you'd send him to my father's house, for I have five brothers that he may testify to them. So they won't also come into this place of torment. But Abraham said to him, they have Moses and the prophets. Let them listen to them. He said, no, Father Abraham, but if one goes to them from the dead, they will repent. So he's asking Abraham to send someone from the dead back to his brothers to warn them so that they don't act like a bunch of greedy fools too and end up in the same place. And I'd like to focus on this. He said to him, if they don't listen to Moses and the prophets, neither will they be persuaded if one rises from the dead. This little section is added to the story by Yeshua. And I believe this is pointed directly at the Pharisees, that they're just like that rich man. And Abraham is telling them the truth that if they don't listen to Moses and the prophets, which he's just showed them, that they're not, right? They're teaching something else than Moses and the prophets, and someone was sent to them, the very Son of God, neither will they be persuaded if one rises from the dead. And somebody did, didn't they? Yeshua, Messiah. And were they persuaded? Some individuals were, but on the whole, no. And so I think it's very telling where this story ends up. So even though it's a morality story, yet Yeshua brings it to a place that's very real, because what happened to them, because they did not believe the one that was sent, who rose from the dead, because of that, destruction was brought upon them in the year 70. And they experienced conditions very much like the story. Fire. Rome burned the whole thing. And it was horrible. Horrible. Very, very much like this story. As far as what the scriptures actually say, for the majority of those who die, they're going to be raised up in what the scriptures indicate as the second resurrection. There's going to be a first resurrection when Messiah comes that's just going to involve those who belong to him. And those who are truly his disciples, who followed him and did everything that he says that a disciple is supposed to do, which is basically give up everything else, right? And follow him, putting him first. They're going to be in the first resurrection. This is what we are striving for. But then there is another resurrection, which you could call the general resurrection of mankind. That's the resurrection that likely would apply to people like Lazarus and the rich man, because all that is about their deeds. It's not about faith in Yeshua. It's about their deeds. And this resurrection at the end of the thousand-year reign of Messiah, it's about people's deeds. And I'm just going to quickly read this. After the 1,000 years, I saw a great white throne and him who sat on it, from whose face the earth and the heaven fled away. There was found no place for them. I saw the dead, the great and the small, the rich man and the beggar, standing before the throne, and they opened books. Another book was opened, which is the book of life. Everything you do is written down in the book of life. The dead were judged out of the things which were written in the books according to their works. According to their works. Notice that it says according to their works. These aren't people who necessarily even knew who Yeshua was. This is all the dead. This is some pagan guy off in China, right? This is some Mongol who fought with Attila the Hun. This is like anybody. Many of whom never even knew there was a Torah. But every one of them had the image of God stamped upon their spirit. Every one of them knew within themselves what is right and wrong, just like you do. And so they're going to be judged according to their works. The sea gave up the dead who were in it. Death and Sheol, notice it mentions Sheol. That's where it showed Lazarus and the rich man to be in the parable. Death and Sheol gave up the dead who were in them. They were judged, each one according to his works. Death and Sheol were thrown into the lake of fire. This is the second death, the lake of fire. If anyone was not found written in the book of life, he was cast into the lake of fire. So, if I was to apply this to the parable, I'm seeing the rich man who has just recently been cast into the lake of fire. So he's not consumed yet. But it is the second death, and even death itself is going to be swallowed up. So this doesn't indicate that people are going to be living on in the lake of fire. The lake of fire itself is not going to exist anymore after it has done its purpose. But a lot that's in the story couldn't really happen. You know, if you were thrown into even, say, a bonfire that you have out in your yard here, is one drop of water on your tongue going to refresh you or help you in any way? You know, the story is obviously meant to be dramatic. It's not reality. However, there is a similar reality that is going to happen for every person. Every person one day if they're not part of the first resurrection, is going to be part of this great white throne judgment, which will determine their eternal future. And I think it's important for us to understand that. And like I was saying, really, our whole life here is really about there. That's really what it's all about. And so what people do is very important. Well, you know, some people read this and say, well, it can't be according to their works because the only way to be saved is by Yeshua Messiah. But who do you think is sitting on the throne judging these people? Isn't it Yeshua? This may be their very first encounter with Yeshua. Maybe if they're smart, they get down on their knees and say, oh, I am so sorry for the things I did. Can you save me? Or, who are you? Get out of my face. People will show how they feel about Yeshua, and it will determine their eternal situation. Well, I just want to point out that these verses, these things that Yeshua had to say, are so relevant in our day. Because today, that false god Mammon is on a rampage, more so literally than any time in history ever. It's really amazing. Without getting into a lot of political stuff, I like the comment on this picture, so I want to read it. The free market is subverted when corporations can acquire laws and buy public opinion. This is our problem. You know, we all know socialism is not a good thing, right? And there's a lot of people now calling for socialism. Why are they doing that? It's because the wealthy are like totally out of control. So this is why some people are calling for socialism. But of course, if you have socialism, then it'll be those people that are sucking up all the wealth. So it doesn't improve anything. It just makes things worse. But the people who don't want socialism, they say, well, we can't do anything that's going to upset capitalism. But, you know, the dirty little secret is that we haven't had capitalism for a long time in America. Capitalism was the mom and pop store you used to go to when you were a kid. That's capitalism, where people, individual people, can squirrel together a little bit of money and start a little business where they provide something for their neighbors to make a living for themselves, and their neighbors can do the same thing. And that's how the economy works, okay? That's capitalism, and that's a good thing. But we don't have that now. What we have now is corporatism. And corporatism is not fair. What corporatism is about is the super wealthy people form these corporations, and they're funded with millions or billions of dollars, right? And under the laws, a corporation has all the same rights as a person. So if you as a person go up against a corporation, who's going to win? The corporation will win every time. And what we see is the bigger fish eating the big fish, and then the fish bigger than them are eating them. All of the wealth is consolidating. This is what is happening in the world. And it is so much what Yeshua was talking about. It is this demonic god, Mammon, that is behind this, fueling all of this greed. People are dying because of this. Unrest in the world is occurring because of this. These people who have all of this money, make no mistake, even in so-called democratic countries, it's not the people who are deciding what they want. It's these multi-billionaires and the corporations that are calling all the shots, because they have the wealth to lay on all the politicians to get what they want. They're just like the dishonest manager, making friends. And they're making lots and lots and lots of friends at the expense of the common ordinary person and the poor. These guys are exactly the rich man in the parable we were just reading. In January of 2019, they held the Davos Economic Forum. And Oxfam, as it does every year, came out with their figures showing where the wealth of the world resides. And what they found is that 26 really rich people have as much wealth as the poorest half of the world. So over here, you've got 3.5 billion people. 3.5 billion people. And over here, you've got 26 people that control just as much wealth. That's a little lopsided, don't you think? So like each of those 3.5 billion people get a piece of the pie that's like, oh, you know what? I can't even show it to you. And each of the 26 people are getting a piece of the pie big as like the moon or something. I mean, the difference is so gigantic. In a world where we have 6,000 people a day starving to death, how evil is that? I don't think the lake of fire is really out of place for people who would be stuffing their own bank accounts while they're watching other people die. But you know what they say about it is, well, the problem is overpopulation. There's just too many people in the world. No. No, there aren't too many people in the world. There's plenty in the world for every person to have everything they need. It's just that there's a few people that are hogging it all. That's what's happened. And don't even begin to think anybody's going to displace these people anytime soon. Because here's what's happening. The bottom half of the population, their wealth is falling by 11% a year, while the wealth of the wealthiest people is increasing by 12% a year. So they've got this built into the system. It's like they've got this giant magnet that's sucking all the wealth out of people's pockets. It's all going up. And along the way, some of it stops in the pockets of the politicians and other people who are useful to the elite. And when you really understand this and where the wealth is, where the power is, it's not hard at all to believe that before long we will have a one world government, because that's a lot more efficient to get a hold of more wealth and to control the whole world for the benefit of these elite people. And we're not that far from that happening. So that's where we're at. And you know, there's so many things that we could look at to show that we're in the last days, that we're near the end of this age. But I don't think there's anything, if you actually understand the implications, that is more compelling than these facts. This is really quite astounding. So here's the point for us who are followers of Yeshua Messiah. I also say, use this earthly wealth, however acquired, to make friends with Yahweh and his son so that when it is gone, they will receive you and you will have everlasting habitation. Friends, let us store up our treasures in heaven.
You have been listening to Hebraic Insights in the Gospels. The scriptures referenced in today's program are Luke chapter 16, Malachi chapter 3, verse 8, Matthew chapter 14, verse 3, Revelation chapter 20, verse 7, and Revelation chapter 20, verse 11 through verse 15. Further teachings and study materials on tithing and where it originates in scripture, Storing Up Treasure in Heaven, The Matrix series from Eliyahu's radio program On the Road to Zion with Eliyahu and Don, The Torah and the Prophets, What the Torah and Messiah Teach About Divorce and Biblical Marriage, The Hope of the Resurrection, The Judgment of the Wicked, The Thousand-Year Reign, The Great White Throne Judgment at the End of the Thousand-Year Reign, What the Bible Teaches About Heaven and Hell, The Lake of Fire, and the Book of Revelation, along with many other related topics, can be found at our membership site, Zion Tabernacle. Sign up is free. Just go to zion.net. That's TSIYON.NET. New programs on the Gospels will be airing every Sabbath on Zion Road Radio. Tune in next Shabbat to learn more from Hebraic Insights in the Gospels. Shabbat Shalom! Ask for the ancient paths. Ask where the good way is. And walk in it. And you'll find a rest for your soul. Would you like to hear more of Eliyahu's teachings? Do you have a question or prayer request and would like to get in touch with one of our volunteers for help? Or do you just want to know more about Eliyahu ben David and Zion Ministry? Visit our website at zion.org, where you can listen to more teachings from Eliyahu ben David straight from the homepage of our website. Check out our books, DVDs, internet videos, and other social media outlets. Learn more about Eliyahu and the Zion team on the About page. See what our ministry's mission is on the Remnant Vision page. Send a question or prayer request from our Contact Us page. Or click Join Us in the menu bar to learn about our community site, Zion Tabernacle. To find out more about Zion Ministry, go to zion.org. That's zion.org, spelled TSION.org.